a fifth commandment today.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Now that we're all the way up to number five, it doesn't take quite as much explanation, right? Not the Ten Commandments from Scripture, but based on them, some rules for us to understand, some essentials for us to understand about Christianity, the way we should think about the world, and the way we should live. Today's a particularly morally based discussion, and so it fits appropriately to describe it as a command. It is the golden rule, as it turns out, although I think it merits more conversation, explanation, and understanding than often comes with the golden rule itself. So that's what we'll do. This is a topic I've discussed a number of times in different contexts, in different episodes on this podcast and on the radio in the years before we were doing it as a podcast. And so this one is a simple one. Number five, it's based on the rule about adultery. Thou shalt not commit adultery, based on number seven of the Ten Commandments. But it is much broader than that. It is apply every rule to everyone, including you. While this sounds commonsensical, if you're going to apply a rule to everyone else, of course you should apply it to yourself, and it is that commonsensical, it is also further reaching than a lot of us would understand, I think. So I'll just begin from the beginning and see where it goes from there. Exodus 20, the reference to the actual biblical Ten Commandments themselves, the seventh commandment, you shall not commit adultery. Our topic today is pretty much just a discussion of why the golden rule comes from the nature of that obligation of marriage. Not marriage itself. It doesn't just come from marriage, although it does come from that relationship, that unique relationship that we have with another person who is inherently different from us in some specific way, in an essential way. So why the golden rule comes from the nature of marriage, that's really the underlying topic today. And if we, and I'll say it in two different ways to get us started. If, and I value these two expressions, so I encourage your attention at this moment. If we grasp how universal human nature is, in other words, how universally the value of humanity is distributed among human beings, if we grasp how universal human nature is, then we will treat everyone else with the respect and moral judgment we believe is due to ourselves. It's a natural consequence of understanding the value that everyone has. So if we grasp how universal human nature is, then we treat everyone with the same respect, the same judgment that we would think is due to ourselves. If I invert that, it's also true. If we hold our highest regard for the person in the world we know to be most different from us, if we regard someone with an essential difference from us as being of equal worth, in other words, so if we hold our highest regard for the person in the world we know to be most different from us, then we will grasp how universal human nature is. So why am I saying it this way, that we should apply every rule to everyone, including you, in those two sort of corollary ways of saying it? Because if we start early on in Scripture, in Genesis 2, at the conclusion of the creation, when God then makes man into mankind with man and woman, so he created male and female, he created he them, you know, it's not just a man, but mankind. in that moment of creation, we have built in the foundation to this understanding about how we're supposed to respect those who are most different from us. We have built into it the moment when we see what it means for people to bear the image of God. So in Genesis 2, I'll read you the passage about marriage, about Adam and Eve being brought together. In verse 18, the Lord God said, "It's not good that the man should be alone. It is essential that he have something more than that. I will make him a helper that's perfectly suited to him." Now, out of the ground, the Lord God formed all the beasts and so on, brought them to Adam for him to name, but there's not found for him a helper that is fit, perfectly suited. That's through verse 20, a very brief paraphrase, to make the point that nothing distinct from him was going to work. It had to be something of equal value and worth with him. So the Lord God caused deep sleep to fall on the man, and while he slept, he took one of his ribs. Wouldn't have mattered what he made it from. It's the fact that he made it from him. He took a piece of Adam and made the woman. This is how it describes it in verse 22, and then brought her to the man. And then the man said, "This is at last bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man." The very nature of that statement is to do two different things, put two different things in tension. On the one hand, the fact that she's exactly the same thing as he is, because she's made of his stuff. She can't be different from what he is. She's made of him. And yet at the same moment, she's she and not he. And there is something different about that. That's why it's a complementary with an E relationship, rather than an identical, isometric relationship. It's not just two equals pulling against each other or facing each other at odds. It's not isometric. It is instead complementary. They work together in a way that makes them fit appropriately together while having some distinction, which is very strange because she's made of the same stuff of which he's made. That tension moves forward through the rest of Scripture, and I, you know, have, again, had long conversations about this in the context of Sodom and Gomorrah and other things, having to do with the fundamental morality of that we're describing today, of respecting every other person as being of equal worth with you yourself, or with me, myself. And so the way we'll do that today is to jump from Genesis 2, where in the creation of mankind, we have the distinction that requires equality, or an equality that recognizes a distinction, but not in worth or value. So how does that play out? Well, into the ultimate statement of holiness, or the rule of the Old Testament, and I won't be the judge of that. We'll use Jesus' words in Matthew 22 in a little bit to make the point that this is the central statement of moral judgment in the Old Testament, in Leviticus 19. And I'm going to read several parts of the chapter to make the point in the context of the statement, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself," which is the central, it's the pivotal point in Leviticus 19. In the context of that, there are all kinds of examples where he's saying, you should look at people who are different from you and treat them the same as you. Me, and I know we would normally say the same as yourself, but I mean, my point is to extend that out, you know, try to get my finger out of the podcast and, you know, pointing at you from your phone to say you, I mean you, all of us have to think of it this way. I have to think of it exactly the same way. I can't make a distinction with myself either. So in verse 13, in Leviticus 19, we sort of pick up on this theme. You shall not oppress your neighbor or rob him. So in no way is it okay for you to use your neighbor to get stuff for yourself to their disadvantage. And then he starts giving examples of what that would look like. In other words, not cheating your neighbor, not robbing him, not oppressing him. So for example, the wages of a hired worker shall not remain with you all night until the morning. Yeah, you may be the boss, you may own the bank account, you may have more money, but that doesn't make you more important than the person who's working for you. They have equal worth with you. They have an equal claim on the money that now ought to be theirs because they've done the work for you. And so you don't hang on to it and say, well, you know, I can think better about this. And you may squander this tonight, so I should probably make the judgment. No, that you should have the same regard for their judgment regarding their money as you do for your ability to use your judgment to use your money the way you want to use it. So the wages of a hired worker shall not remain with you all night until the morning. You shall not curse the deaf, but they can't even hear. It doesn't matter. They are of equal worth with you. So you don't use the fact that they can't hear to say something. You don't even have to be behind their back, right? Oh, I can just speak about them. You can't do that. You have to regard them in the same way you would regard anyone else, or that you would regard anyone else who was cursing you. You shall not curse the deaf or put a stumbling block before the blind, but you shall fear your God. I am the Lord. And that's the basis of all of these arguments as Moses is making them for us in the book of Leviticus. He lays them down and doesn't say, and let me explain to you the details of this. The detail in it is we're all made with the dignity of bearing the image of God. And so if the Lord your God is your God, then he's the God for everyone else also. You should be regarding everyone with equal worth. You shall fear your God. I am the Lord. He goes on with examples. You shall do no injustice in court. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great. You don't give an advantage to someone because they have more power or have less power, because they are able to pay more money or because they have less money. You're not partial to the poor or defer to the great. But in righteousness, you shall judge your neighbor. This does raise problems for us as we consider our criminal justice system. I'm not going off on a long lecture about the criminal justice system, and I'm not pretending I have any easy solutions for all of this. We don't have space in our jails. I get that. We don't have room on our court dockets. I get that. But it is at least somewhat troubling that if a person has plenty of money, they get to go home while they wait for their trial. And if they don't have a lot of money, they have to stay in the jail while they're waiting for their trial. Not while they're guilty, while they're waiting for the trial that's going to determine whether they're guilty or not. That's the reason we ask those questions. And again, I recognize it's not an easy answer. I can't just say, oh, well, then we should get rid of the bail system, the bond system, or we should just get rid of probation, or we should just get rid of. I'm not presuming that there's an easy answer to any of this, but I'm saying that's why we have to talk about it differently. That's why we have to regard it differently. Not because there are bleeding heart liberals who think we ought to handle the world differently, but because we're not supposed to be partial to the poor or to the wealthy, but in righteousness, judge our neighbor. We ought to be able to make clean judgments in the way we regard other human beings. You shall not, he goes on in verse 16 to say, go around as a slanderer among your people, and you shall not stand up against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. Meaning, if you don't want people going around and slandering you, saying negative things about you, maybe even some of them are true, well, you know, I wouldn't say it, but I think it's the case that so-and-so is doing so-and-so. If you don't want people walking around doing that about you, well, then you wouldn't do it against your neighbor, because they bear the same image of God you bear, and he is the Lord, not us. In verse 17, going on in Leviticus 19, he says, you shall not, and this is driving right to the core of the message, you shall not hate your brother in your heart, but you shall reason frankly with your neighbor. He's going from brother to neighbor, lest you incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. Now, I know at that point, we realize he's saying we have to treat other people with the same respect we'd give ourselves. But here, he's very specific. It's your brother. In Judaism, it's that Jewish neighbor you have, that Israeli who's also living in Canaan with you and following the laws of God and recognizes Yahweh, and all of that's absolutely true. But that's the point of this sort of chiastic chapter in Leviticus 19, where it works down to a central point in verse 17 and then expands the application out from there again in the rest of the chapter, so that in verse 32, we're back to recognizing that our neighbor, in the way Jesus does it in the New Testament, when the scribe says to him, "And who is my neighbor?" And Jesus has to say, "Everyone, you idiot." He doesn't say idiot because he's not like me. But he does say, "Everyone, the person you would think least like you, a dirty Samaritan, that's your neighbor." And let me give you the example. And then he tells the Good Samaritan story. That's the point. So the same thing happens in Leviticus 19, where picking up in verse 32, he says, "You shall not stand up before the gray head." Well, you know, I'm getting closer to that, by the way. I still don't have much gray hair. I've got a little bit. But, I mean, it's coming to me, so I would look at that and say, "Oh, yeah, that's the person just like me." But, I mean, he's writing it to all the people who have the power, the younger people who are, you know, living their lives and, you know, all those old people, they just need to be put to the side. Can't do that. "You shall stand up before the gray head." That is, stand with honor. Give honor and respect. "Stand up before the gray head and honor the face of an old man, and you shall, by doing that, fear your God. I am the Lord." You're recognizing the Lord your God when you see the image of God in the person in front of you. If you don't see the image of God in the human being that's in front of you, then you've forgotten who the Lord your God is. That's what it means for us to be followers of God. And as we follow him, to recognize the respect we have to have for his image in this world, which is in every single person. So before the old, he says, "You stand up and show them respect. That's how you know I am the Lord. You shall," and then he goes on to say, "When a stranger," this is, now we've gone completely in these concentric circles that I've talked about in prior episodes to have this whole discussion. You get all the way out to the farthest circle. A stranger, a person you don't know, don't have any reason to trust, and you have no idea what their intentions are. "When a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall do him no wrong. You shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as if he were a native among you, as if he were born here. And you shall love him as yourself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God." I just want to pause for a moment and say, if your mind is working right now trying to find a way around that verse, well, let's just mitigate that. I mean, after all, it's about, you know, if your mind is racing in that direction, let me just beg you to do what I had to do a few years ago and ask you to stop explaining scriptures away and start letting them stare you in the face until you change. Because it's a good change when it comes. And it's the change God wants in us. So I'll read it again. This is what it says. "When a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall do him no wrong. You shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as a native among you." That doesn't mean we don't enforce laws. The native among us faces enforced laws as well, but they should face exactly the same kind of enforcement. "So you shall love him as yourself, because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God." There are very few people in the world I know that that statement should mean more to than Americans. We were strangers in this land. You know, all of us, we all moved here from outside. Unless you are Native American, you were all brought here just a few hundred years ago. So you were strangers in the land of Egypt, but I am the Lord your God. I'm the person who gives you dignity. My presence in you, your image of me in you, is what gives you this position that you have, and you have to see that in every person. So he goes on in verse 35 to say, "You shall do no wrong in judgment." This is what reminds us that this is on the basis that we love our neighbor as ourselves, because we don't get the prerogative of treating different people differently in any setting. So he chooses the marketplace to come to the conclusion here and says, "You shall do no wrong in judgment. In measures of length or weight or quantity, you shall have just balances, just weights, a just ephah, a just hin." How on earth is a balance righteous? Is a weight righteous? Is an ephah righteous? Is a hin righteous? Because that's the word he's using for it. How do you have just any of that? Because you treat every person with exactly the same one, the same standard, the same measure. And why do we do that? Because Yahweh is the Lord our God who brought us up out of the land of Egypt. That's how it says it in Leviticus 19 to make the point. Now, at this point, you can be thinking to yourself, well, this is a favorite topic of you, but why are you saying this is an essential to Christianity, that it's so important? Well, let's take it back to the words of Jesus in two examples. Number one, in the Sermon on the Mount, and again, I've done previous episodes on this, so I won't dwell on it as much as we could, and I'll ask Daisy to link to some of the prior episodes where we've given more detailed explication to this. But in Matthew 7, in the Sermon on the Mount, the statement at the beginning of Matthew 7, as he's driving toward the conclusion of the Sermon on the Mount, is, "Judge not that you be not judged." For now, that is an important statement to change our attitude so we're not so judgmental. I mean, it's fine to use it that way. But there's a lot more detail to it in the passage itself, because what he says, even just in the second verse, is, "Because with the judgment you pronounce, you yourself will also be judged. And with the measure you use, that measure will also be measured to you." The point of it is that the same rule that applies to someone else also applies to you. And in this case, he's making the point that if that's the case, you're closer to yourself than you are to the other person. So you should be applying that rule to yourself before you apply it to anyone else. Hence, the words of this commandment apply every rule to everyone, including you. And that's the meaning of the golden rule, which comes 10 verses later in Matthew 7, 12, after verse 2, 10 verses later. "So whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets." And, you know, when I was growing up, I always heard as the kid, well, you know, the Christian way of saying it is fairly positive. Whatever you wish others would do to you, do also to them. But the Buddhist way of saying this was negative, and it is in a lot of other religions true. So, too, so whatever you wish that others would not do to you, do not do to them, and so on. But actually, in Matthew 7, it's both negative and positive. Do not judge unless you are willing to have that judgment applied to you. Don't do to others what you don't want them to do to you. That's the point. And then saying it positively at the end of the bracketed passage down through verse 12, so whatever you wish that others would do to you, you do also to them. Because this is why I'm treating it as one of the essentials of Christianity, one of those 10 things that you can use as a rule of thumb just to measure yourself and say, am I really still following Jesus? Or have I just adopted sort of some religious practices? Because a part of following Jesus, it seems essential, is recognizing that whatever rule you're going to have for anyone else has to apply to yourself. Because Jesus concludes the passage that says that's the case with these words, "This is the law and the prophets." This is the rule among all the other rules. Yeah, I said don't do this and don't do that, but you want to know what the rule is? It is apply every rule to every person, including yourself. We don't get any exceptions with it. And how do I know it's that important again for Jesus? Well, he said here it was the entire law and prophets. In Matthew 22, when the Pharisees heard that Jesus, in a certain set of discussions, had silenced the Sadducees, you know, you love the competition between the Pharisees and Sadducees. Well, I bet we can take him down. Those Sadducees, they can't do anything right. So the Pharisees get together, and one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law? Let's just see if this guy knows his stuff." And he said to him, now obviously there are a bunch of reasons they would have asked that question, because there's a competition among them about how the laws are to be understood and hierarchically, how we're supposed to put them together and so on. So they ask, well, so which one do you think is the great commandment? Because you know, if you're debating a topic every day, you can find the fault in any answer. There's always something that limits the answer, right? So Jesus is going to give an answer that there's no answer to. And he said to him, well, here it is. It's pretty straightforward. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment, the Shema. Who's going to argue with that? But the second is just like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. He doesn't say the second is slightly inferior to it, but also important. The second is just like it. You can't say, I love God, and then say, I hate my neighbor, and say, but I'm keeping half the law. No. The whole law hangs on those two together. This is how he says it. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets. And if you were listening to the discussion on Leviticus 19, not to imply you weren't, I didn't mean that in an insulting way. The point is, if you heard what I was saying in Leviticus 19, you heard God making this point over and over and over again. Why do you have to love your neighbor as yourself? Because I am the Lord your God. Because the command to love our neighbors as ourselves is built on the understanding that they bear the image of God, that the dignity of their worth is the testimony to the worth of God to us. If we love our God, we will love our neighbor exactly the same way. And that means everyone. This is why there's no exception to it. So, you know, how does that apply? I mean, what does it actually come out to look like? I can give you some illustrations. I've given these illustrations in the past. I'll give a couple of them and then we'll move on. One illustration, I always use traffic as the illustration. Students seem to get this, and then they sort of understand why, as I've referred to this in the past, it comes out in more modern or Enlightenment versions of ethics as a Kantian ethic. And it is a really great expression. Kantian ethics is a great expression of what the golden rule is all about. And in traffic, it just means recognizing that the rules that apply to you should apply to everyone else. The exceptions that apply to you also have to apply to everyone else. Any rule that applies to everyone else also has to apply to you, and so on. And so, an example is just driving on the shoulder. When people get impatient, you know, and they rush up ahead by getting on the shoulder and going around everyone so that they can get in front because the traffic jams up there. I've got places to be. And we're saying, oh, I'm special now, so I get to go up front. The whole value to that is that not everyone does it. And in fact, you start seeing when somebody does that and they succeed at it, everybody else starts doing it. And then you just have a traffic jam with four lanes trying to merge into two or one instead of three lanes trying to merge into two or one. And so it's just worse for everyone. But a few people got a little advantage. They got the advantage. Why? Because they said to themselves, well, everyone else is staying in those three lanes, and that's what we're supposed to do. But I think I can get an advantage if I take the shoulder. How do I get that advantage? Well, if everyone else stays in their lane. So I need everyone else to have a rule that keeps them in their lane, but I can use the rule that I can get on the shoulder. Is traffic all that important? Am I just bitter because I was in a bad traffic jam the other day? Honestly, that's not it. In fact, my rule of thumb is if somebody's trying to get in front of me, back up a little and let them get in front of me. It's not worth the hassle or the struggle or the anxiety that goes with traffic to try to hassle about it. I don't want to do that. This is not a personal thing. It's a recognition that the basis for being able to get in front of everybody else in that circumstance is also the basis by which we determine when we can sort of break the rules everyone else ought to keep and suddenly find ourselves doing things that, if we were to admit it or everyone else were to do it, we would have to admit made it wrong. You know, it didn't actually turn out to be that great an advantage. Now, in Kantian terms, we recognize that it's wrong because it's irrational. It creates a contradiction. Well, if everybody can do it, if everybody ought to do it, and so on. Go back and listen to where we've talked about the categorical imperative and Kantian ethics in the past. Again, Daisy will link to some of those shows, and you'll have an opportunity to get some of the details on that. But it just, it is an explanation in non-morally significant terms, you know, driving on the shoulder, to understand why we don't get to make special rules for ourselves. Cheating is the same way. If we said, you know, I need to cheat on this exam so that I can pass, so I can finally go into ministry and make a difference in people's lives. Think about how hypocritical that is, by the way. But anyway, if we were to try to say that, how would we know that there was something wrong with that? Well, in terms of this universality that we have to apply, it would come with recognizing that tests themselves would be meaningless if we said that what a person ought to do if they can't succeed on the test otherwise is just cheat, you know, just use a few answers that you're given ahead of time or whatever would make it possible to do that, then the test would become meaningless. There's no reason to take the test at all. It reveals the hypocrisy in thinking that we can make exceptions for ourselves. Lying is the example that has moral weight to it, but also reveals the sort of hypocrisy of inconsistency if we apply different rules to different people in the circumstance. What makes a lie succeed, and again, I'm trying to kind of rush through these because we've talked about them in the past, and so I don't think we have to spend as much time on it today, but what makes a lie successful, what every lie requires in order to be successful, is what I refer to as a truth-telling environment. It requires people to assume that unless the motives are extremely important and there's some severe circumstance, people tell the truth. People just generally tell the truth. I wouldn't walk into a room of strangers and say, huh, it's raining outside, and expect them to say to me, wait a minute, do you mean that's true, or are you saying something just to be funny? I would expect them to think I'm telling the truth because we live in a truth-telling environment. The assumption, the assumed preface to every sentence is, it is true that, and then we start speaking our sentence. That's, we don't say it. We don't need to say it. The meaning of the sentence is its truth value. That's the point of it. So every lie goes on the assumption that people are going to think that you're telling the truth unless they have a really strong reason for denying that you are. So to tell a lie, we have to say two contradictory things at the same time. Number one, first thing I have to say is, the thing a person ought to do in my situation is tell a lie. Now, why do I have to say that? Because what determines what I'm going to do in a situation is what I think I ought to do. Not what, I may not think every person ought to do it, but I think I ought to do it. I'm thinking of myself as a person, so I'm putting all things in equality and saying to myself, I think the thing you ought to do here is just go ahead and lie. Just tell the policeman you were driving the speed limit. Let's see if we can get out of this ticket because you need that money for your son's birthday party or your grandson's birthday party and blah, blah, blah. Whatever the excuse is, we find some way to say what I ought to do in this situation is tell a lie. At the same moment, I have to say this second thing. The thing every other person ought to believe everyone ought to do in this situation is tell the truth, so that they'll think that I think everyone else ought to tell the truth right now, and that I think I ought to tell the truth right now, so that they'll believe what I'm about to say. To abbreviate that, I need to say these two things at the same moment. The thing a person ought to do in my situation is tell a lie, and the thing every other person ought to do in this situation is tell the truth. In other words, I treat myself as an exception to everyone else in order to justify my lie. Treating myself as an exception is to regard others with a different frame, a different standard of reference, or a different measuring stick than the one with which I'm regarding myself. To use a phrase I'm instructed I should not use, not complicated. I am treating other people with a different frame of reference, giving them a different set of values, giving them literally a different value than I give to myself. I am important enough that in this situation, I don't have to follow the same rules that all of you should follow and think that I am following in this particular situation. So I require everyone else to have a different obligation in this situation than I have in this situation. That is the opposite, not only of the golden rule, but of understanding everyone else of having equal value with me in this situation. There's a lot of evidence, we could go on and on about this one, that we don't do this, that we're not good at doing this. We are very good, and this is the only evidence I'll give for it in this discussion broadly. I'll give a couple of examples. Of diminishing respect for individuals from other cultures. That's where we do it the best. That's why there is the special statement in Leviticus 19 about how we regard strangers. Outsiders are people from different cultures. Maybe they speak a different language. Maybe they just have different cultural practices. Whatever it is, they're just different from us. We tend to treat people from different cultures as having a diminished value. Hence, we have diminished respect for individuals from other cultures in general. Not everybody does. I'm not saying everybody does it every day. And I'm not saying we can't overcome it. But our general practice is to have a slightly diminished respect for individuals from other cultures, which you recognize when you realize how much you respect people who you think are just like you. It's an embarrassing feature of our nature. I mean, mine too. All of us as human beings. It's just part of who we are. What are examples of that? You know, diminished respect for individuals from other cultures. Well, punishing everyone from a nationality or a region or a language group because someone from their nationality or region or language group committed a crime or an offense or an atrocity. Again, inductively, it's natural that we jump to conclusions like we do. Oh, no, those people are dangerous. But doing that is evidence that we have begun to diminish the amount of respect that we're willing to give to people from that particular cultural group. For instance, thinking that Muslims are terrorists because some Muslims have been terrorists. Some Muslims have been terrorists. That's just part of the reality of our history. The assumption, therefore, that all Muslims ought to be regarded with a little more suspicion because some Muslims have been terrorists is evidence that we are willing to diminish our respect for individuals from other cultures. It's the same with immigrants in general. If an immigrant commits a crime, all of a sudden, all immigrants need to be under more severe scrutiny because some immigrants commit crimes. Some immigrants do commit crimes. That's true. Is it right, then, to put all immigrants under additional scrutiny because some immigrants committed crimes? Some of you right now, you're nodding as hard as you can nod, going, well, of course you do. Who wouldn't be smart enough to start analyzing our immigrants more cautiously when an immigrant commits a crime? Yet, the Oklahoma City bomber speaks English, he's mighty white, he was before he was executed, and questions the government's authority, but we're not inclined to lock up every white person who speaks English. We're not inclined even to look dubiously at every white person who speaks English and lives in some enclave in a rural community. Some do, some don't, to be fair. But that's it. It's only because they're different that we would do that. My point is, every kind of person commits crimes, and we can therefore judge all humanity as being under suspicion. That would be fine. If a person were like that, a genuine cynic of all human nature, then I wouldn't be offering this as the criticism of them. I wouldn't say that's a great position for us to be in. That's not how we're supposed to act. But it would be for a different reason. But that's not what we do. What we tend to do is pick out people who have easily distinguishable features, which the most easily distinguishable features are cultural, including the racial ones that we identify. So, you know, thinking, let me give that example as well. Thinking one way about black men carrying weapons, walking around a neighborhood at night, but thinking a different way about white men patrolling their neighborhood at night, that would be evidence that we're pretty good at diminishing respect for individuals who might have a slightly different culture than we do. And I hear that distinction made on a regular basis. I've heard Hispanic homeowners describing how often they are approached when they're working in their own yard and asked how much they charge to do a lawn. Now, I understand nobody means any harm by that, but it tells you that a person, when they drive by and see a Hispanic man working in a yard, might think to themselves, oh, he's out working hard. I think I'll get him to come work in my yard. Rather than what you think when you drive by a white man mowing his yard. Oh, look at that man taking good care of his yard. Isn't it funny how good we are at diminishing the level of respect we offer to individuals because they come from a different culture? It's not necessarily even an immediate evil to have stereotypes within which we understand the avenues down which a lot of similar people walk. There are a lot of Hispanic landscapers in North Texas. It's not surprising at all that somebody would make that judgment. But it is definitely an indication of how quickly and efficiently we can separate classes of people and effectively create castes from those mental separations. That is, how susceptible we are to diminish the level of respect we give to certain individuals because they happen to be from a different culture. And from those non-judgmental, or at least not intentionally judgmental, utilitarian distinctions that we make, it's only a hop, skip, and a jump to labeling people and then firewalling our empathy for them behind our own need for security or the importance of our own identity, which is all a legitimate part of our consideration. But then suddenly realizing that we're no longer treating them the way we would hope to be treated if, which is actually a when, we're ever in their situation. Because eventually, as Solzhenitsyn points out, they do come for you. It always happens. So, you know, here's the point today. Here's to remembering that the person least like us in the world is the most important reminder in the world that we're all exactly the same before God. He is, after all, no respecter of persons. It says about him repeatedly. So we can only, and this is the point, we can only respect every person as having equal dignity when no person's respect comes at the expense of another's. A sentence worth repeating. We can only respect every person as having equal dignity when no person's respect comes at the expense of another person's respect. That means applying every rule to everyone, including you.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.